Good evening and welcome to our latest Town Hall Forum, a chance for the people of San Antonio to come together and take part in a solutions-based conversation about the challenges that face our city. I'm Terry Gilday, and I want to welcome you to our wonderful venue, the San Antonio Central Library Auditorium. Today, tonight we tackle a complex and difficult topic, serving the needs of the homeless in our community. Thousands of men, women, and children live on the streets of San Antonio, existing day to day, looking for food and shelter. Who are they? And what forces have propelled these individuals to a life on the streets? Many of the homeless suffer from debilitating physical and mental health conditions, drug addiction, and many are victims of domestic or random violence. But are privately funded programs and faith-based ministries doing enough to help these individuals, and do they have the resources to help them lead self-sustaining lives? Are city regulations and ordinances, in some instances, helping those organizations or even hindering them at some points? What can we do as a community to address these problems and help lead the homeless? What can we as a community to address these problems that lead to the homeless and help break what is, for some, an endless cycle of poverty? Tonight we've gathered a wonderful panel of individuals that serve the homeless in our city in a number of different ways. To my far left is Scott Ackerson. He's the Vice President of Transformational Services at Haven for Hope, a private nonprofit organization focusing on improving the lives of the homeless in Bexar County. Scott oversees clinical and education programs at Haven's 1,000-plus bed campus and courtyard facility in downtown San Antonio. He helps implement Haven's mission to provide critical social services to the homeless with the hopes of transforming them into self-sufficient individuals on a long-term basis. Scott, thanks for being here tonight.
Thank you.
To my left is Taylor Boone. He's the associate pastor with the Travis Park United Methodist Church. Reverend Boone has been serving the homeless in San Antonio since 2000 when he joined Travis Park UMC as a layperson. Since becoming an ordained minister, Reverend Boone currently serves as the president of Corazon Ministries Incorporated, the church's primary outreach arm. Reverend Boone is also an attorney, and he says serving in both the worlds of law and ministry allow him to build bridges between those in poverty and those with wealth and power. Taylor, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Terry.
To my right is Marta Pelais. She's the president and CEO of Family Violence Prevention Services. It's a nonprofit that seeks to break cycles of domestic violence and strengthen families through its programs of emergency shelter, transitional housing, education, and other services. At Family Violence Prevention Services, Marta initially directed the Substance Abuse Intervention Program for the youth. She became chief program officer before becoming the agency's president and CEO. Marta, thanks for joining us tonight. And to my far right is Melody Woosley. She's the assistant director of the San Antonio Community Initiatives Department and works specifically with homeless services. Her responsibilities include oversight and management of many human service areas of the department, including homeless initiatives, Head Start, family assistance centers, among others. She's held the position of assistant director of the office for 3 years. Melody, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We're now going to give our panel an opportunity to do some opening statements, just a 1 to 2 minute statement talking about who they are and the organization that they represent. And Scott, can we begin with you?
Certainly, and welcome everybody. Scott Ackerson, Haven for Hope. I actually had worked for SAM Ministries for about 3 years before going to Haven, so I've been watching with great interest the building, the development of this project, both from a community partner perspective and now from an internal perspective. My career in social services, I'm a social worker by trade, spans about 25 years, a lot of years in child welfare, worked with youth emancipating from foster care, and been in homeless services for about 5 years now. Haven for Hope, really in a nutshell, really represents a major paradigm shift in the way this community is addressing homelessness and looking at homelessness. From my SAM Ministries side, you know, for 26 years, SAM Ministries has been providing the SAM shelter, the emergency shelter, among other services. But the primary service really has been an overnight line where you get a bed ticket, you get a shower, you get a meal, and you leave the next day. When I first started there, one of the program directors pointed to somebody a line and said, "This guy has been coming here every day for 15 years. And my question to that was, do we consider that a success? And as a community, is that what we wanted to see as successful? So I'm excited at the direction that we're going with Haven, and I'm excited to be a part of that project.
Thanks, Scott. Taylor?
It's good to see so many friends here tonight. Travis Park, as a church, 12 years ago, I would say the young adults, the 20-somethings, decided that they were tired of having a meal in a church and not being able to invite people on the street, like veterans and other people who are homeless. And so the young people said, we want to start a meal. And that meal started with one breakfast and now goes to where we feed 250 people every Sunday. But we used to have grants from the city, and we ran a day center. But the funds were moved over to Haven for Hope when that was opened. But our whole mission is one person at a time, unconditional justice and love. We believe that transformation comes through God. We accept everyone. No one's turned away. And in that regard, one of the ways that we learned to expand our services is we asked people who were homeless what they needed. And if I had one suggestion for tonight's program and future programs for this type of thing, might be instead of having panelists that provide services, perhaps letting the community actually hear the articulate, competent people that are homeless speak their minds in a way that they suggest things. And I think that would be just as interesting, if not more so, than having the professional panelists and priests and pastors up here, because they have a lot to say. I've learned so much from my brothers and sisters on the street. Many of them are far closer to Christ than anyone sitting in a church.
Thank you, Taylor. Marta?
Good evening. Marta Pelaez with Family Violence Prevention Services. I'm delighted to be here and to have an opportunity to have a conversation to discuss the crossroads between homelessness and domestic violence in our community. Family Violence Prevention Services, something that is probably not very well known, is an agency, umbrella agency, that houses 16 different programs. One of its programs is the Battered Women and Children's Shelter. If you all remember, we began 33 years ago. Those who remember, 33 years ago, it was a women's center to provide respite, maybe a night or two, for a mother and a child who was involved in a domestic violence situation. We didn't ask, we didn't know the relationship between homelessness and domestic violence. 33 years later, we know differently. We have developed programs to move women from homelessness, who because that is what they are when they come to the shelter. They have lost the place they called home. And our services attempt and are directed towards moving them to a situation of self-sufficiency. My background is in clinical psychology. I have, for the longest time, provided services to vulnerable populations, children who have been abused, parents who abused children, and now I thought that I would put it all together and provide my services to an agency that attempts to move people to a place of self-sufficiency.
Thank you, Marta. Melody?
Good evening. I'm Melody Woosley with the City of San Antonio Department of Community Initiatives, and I'm so pleased to see so many of you here tonight when there's so many things going on in the community that you could be doing other than discussing this topic. But it's important this time of year, and it's important all year round. And just as some background, in 2005, the community adopted a 10-year plan to end chronic homelessness for San Antonio and Bexar County. This plan included the development of a comprehensive data management system, but it also included proposed strategies to improve affordable housing, increase the stock of permanent housing in the community, and strategies to prevent homelessness. Additionally, it introduced the idea of closing the two shelters that the city had been operating or owned, the Dwyer Shelter, which the city operated, and the SAM Shelter, which SAM Ministries had opened or that was operating, and the development of a comprehensive homeless campus. And that's really what kicked off in the community the transition that Scott was referring to of viewing homeless strategies as being transformational rather than just housing people overnight. And it also really kicked off the transition of the city's role from being a provider of homeless services to really more of a funder and a manager of contracts and policy for the homeless. And so that's really what has happened in the city recently, is we've gone from actually operating a shelter to coordinating and facilitating policy development, and that's the role that we continue to develop and work through. In addition to Haven for Hope, there's really a lot of other services that are going on. The city is also partnering with homeless agencies throughout the community for transitional shelter and permanent housing. We are the lead agency for the San Antonio and Bexar County Continuum of Care, and there is over $6 million in federal funds that come through that process and go out into the community. So Haven for Hope really is a enormous undertaking and a huge part of the solution, but there are many other activities that are going on in the community around homelessness. And as well, there's many activities around homeless prevention, and the city continues to be a part of ensuring that those services are being provided, everything from utility and rental assistance, because we want to keep people housed. We don't want them to become homeless in the first place. And so our focus, again, is really moving to that policy piece and that homeless prevention piece, while Haven for Hope is kind of handling the emergency shelter piece for the moment.
Thank you, Melody. I just want to add that while we've been preparing for this town hall, we've received a lot of emails and phone calls from a lot of organizations that wanted to be on the panel, and there are so many wonderful organizations in this city, SAM Ministries, the Church Under the Bridge, just to name a few, and I know representatives from those organizations are in the audience tonight. Just because you're not sitting at this table doesn't mean you can't be an active part of this discussion, so I appreciate your enthusiasm. We just had to pick four panelists and move ahead with the topic, but I appreciate everyone's enthusiasm. Please, I would like you all to be a part of this conversation tonight. On that note, we do invite you to participate, and as Ernie said, we encourage you to come forward to the microphone in the aisle. When it's your turn to speak, please state your name, identify yourself. Since this is radio, people will hear this in a few weeks on KSTX, and we want to know who's speaking, so please identify yourself. Oftentimes, people would like to make a statement before they ask their question. That's okay, but remember, the clock is ticking. There are people behind you, so please do your best to get to your question as soon as possible. If you'd like to identify one panelist to ask your question to or open up to the entire panel, that's fine too. This is an emotional topic. There's a lot of emotion and politically charged feelings, I think, in the room tonight. So that's great. We want to hear it all. We want everyone to talk about to passionately speak about this topic, but let's try to keep it civil as much as possible. So I thank you for that. And while individuals are converging on the microphone, I'll start out with just a general question that I'd like to pass off to the panel here. Melody, you mentioned the 2005 plan that the city has introduced, and in that time we've seen the formation of Haven for Hope, but we've also seen SAM Ministries and Travis Park United Methodist Church continue the ministries that they're doing. I want to throw this out, and Scott, maybe we can start with you because you seem to have a lot of experience dealing with the homeless in the city. How have things changed over the last 5 years in San Antonio, not just with the formation of Haven for Hope and other ministries that have come together, but also this economic recession that we're fighting in this country and especially in San Antonio? Have you seen a rise in homelessness? Have you seen a rise in homelessness? And what are we talking about when it comes to the resources and the services that these organizations can provide? I know a broad question, but let's start with that.
Absolutely have seen a change. In my time with SAM Ministries, we started a homeless prevention program. With the Obama administration come in, the stimulus package, that program went from about a $400,000 a year budget to about $2 million a year. And what we were starting to see in that program, have been seeing, is a phenomenon that's now being called the suburban homeless. We saw people coming in for financial assistance that had never accessed social services, never accessed human services, as a byproduct of a bad economy. So the face of homelessness is definitely changing. And statistically, nationwide and in San Antonio, the fastest growing homeless population is families with children. Many perceive homeless as the person standing on the corner. I always ask when I do presentations, what do homeless people look like? And you get the stereotypical answers. A man with long white hair that's doing drugs, sleeping under the bridge, and all of those stereotypes. Those stereotypes are absolutely false. There is not one face of homelessness.
Anybody else on the panel want to contribute to that question? How have things changed with homelessness in our city in the last 5 years, Taylor?
Well, we're seeing more young people on the street, and mental illness has been significantly increased. And I am pleased to see the San Antonio Police Department going through training to be able to work with them. That's been a great help. I've worked some with one of the assistant chiefs here because we were having a lot of mental health commitments. In fact, our criminal justice system is filled with people who have mental illness, and they're not dangerous if they are helped. And for that reason, we started a mental health center at Travis Park and spun it off. It's called the Clubhouse, or our house. We're looking at maybe doing another one since we can't even – there's just not enough time. The other thing that I've seen is that we're not just talking about homeless people. We're talking about folks that are marginalized, that by the second or third week of the month have no money for food, no money for their prescriptions, and the number of people that we're feeding all during the week has increased significantly, and I would like to know, maybe Melody can help, there's a need for having more people feeding right now because Haven for Hope can't take care of that. And I don't think you even are addressing or have the opportunity to address the people who are marginalized, do you? And I'm not trying to cast aspersions at them. This is bigger than all of us, and we've got to work together. I want us to build up, not build down by putting the pressure, but there are too many people that the city needs to let us feed.
Melody, do you want to respond to that?
Absolutely. I think the city totally agrees. I totally agree with you, Reverend Boone. The marginalized population is, you're absolutely right, they're running out of money at the end of the month. They're running out of money at the beginning of the month. And we've invested a lot of funds into agencies like the Food Bank and the Hispanic Religious Partnership to improve access to food stamps and food pantries. We want families that have homes to make their meals in their homes and rather than coming out and eating in parking lots and under the bridge. We believe that there's a great need to have centers where families can go when they do run out of food, and even their food stamps aren't stretching through the month. There's been discussion with the Coalition of Congregations about regional feeding sites so that we can have facilities that can feed families and individuals when they are running out of money at the end of the month, or like I said, when they don't have money at the beginning of the month. We don't want people to go hungry. We understand that that's a huge need in the community and believe that there are strategies for addressing that, and we want to be part of doing that.
Great. Sir, go ahead and identify yourself. Come on up to the microphone.
I'm John Champagne. I'll just reach down here a little bit. So I think some of you are aware of a proposal that would have natural resource wealth equally owned by all of humanity.
I'm not sure where you're going, but does this pertain to our topic at hand tonight?
If we imagine that natural resource wealth is valuable, and some people have problems of low income that we might have elaborate bureaucratic approaches to solving. But if we decided also to take the pressure off of these efforts that are overburdened, we might decide that as we approach an environmental problem that could be solved by attaching fees so that the economy recognizes natural resources as valuable, and if we decide that natural resources belong to everybody, as they pay the fees would go to the people rather than as they change their... We hear about cap and trade, but that's a fraud against the people because while they're trying to reflect the value of these resources so the economy will respond to the challenge, they're not in a philosophical way approaching the question of who owns the air and water. So we're not having a conversation about accounting for externalities so the economy adjusts by sharing the natural resource wealth equally. That means we're missing the possibility that maybe low income doesn't mean no income ever. And if we decide also to change the culture so that we don't accept grocery stores throwing away a slightly blemished or slightly drier orange, slightly blemished tomato, instead, shouldn't we expect that valuable nutrition is going to be at least offered at a going rate, so half price, maybe, just so it's not there in the evening or after 10, whatever they want to do. They don't want that sitting there all day, okay. But we ought not let good nutrition go to waste when our institutional response to this consists of eggs and white flour and sugar and milk as the handout, maybe.
So John,
I'm a little, personally, I don't think
sure.
that's a choice, even respecting all religious traditions, for one thing. But
okay. Can we
discuss how not throwing away food?
Here we go.
Okay, low-income people can afford nutritious food if we stop that practice. And there's reasons why the grocery stores don't want to do that. There's ways to respond to those concerns. We don't even have the conversation, so this is frustrating. But when everybody has a modest income, then get together with your friend in hard times and share an apartment. You can do that. And if people need to learn how to live together, that's what we might be wanting to focus on more, because we don't really need this problem of extreme disparity of wealth in our society if we just recognize it. That distribution of wealth, a big question is, how are we going to distribute the world's natural resource wealth? Because it's going to be grabbed up by corporations, or the people are going to take ownership of it. That's a question of our time, and that's a different approach to the problems we're trying to solve here, I think. And
okay.
Maybe y'all can talk about how a guaranteed, I'm looking for like confidence that you're going to have some income always, and a little help learning how to spend that money, and it'll change in our society so we don't squander resources and throw them away when people are offering money for it. How might that change the conversation here?
So, John, if I may just encapsulate some of your comments. You were talking about equity of wealth, especially when it comes to availability of food from private industry and those kinds of things. Bringing that home to the homeless topic at hand, and our panelists can jump in here. How does a diminished food supply and higher food prices affect homelessness in our community? And I'll just pass this off to anybody who might want. Reverend Boone, do you see issues with this? We were talking about stretching that paycheck from the first week and the second week of the month. Food costs have risen, especially as resources have gotten thinner and our recession looms on. Talk to us a little bit about that, about the higher prices of food and the availability of those.
We rely on the food bank to the extent, but we only probably are able to get 20 to 25% of the food that we use from the food bank, and to get fresh vegetables and other things for other meals, we have to go out and buy them, and we try to work as many deals as we can, networking with other grocery stores and things, but it's difficult to make any kind of headway in that. And so as we are presented with more and more people needing food and more difficulty getting your food stamps. I mean, we take for granted that someone can get a food stamp. Well, first of all, they have to have an ID. There was a great article in the paper this morning about a fella who's been homeless most of his life, and he's been ill. He can't get an ID because they can't even find his birth certificate. That happens. We have people coming in two or three times a day. We did all the Katrina recovery for ID recovery, and our volunteers are now working over at Haven for Hope doing ID recovery. But the numbers are tremendous. And just to assume that you can get ID is a big step. I mean, the mere fact we're having this at 7 o'clock at night indicates that we have a disconnect, that most homeless folks can't even get here at 7 o'clock because they either have to check into their dorm system or they got to go reserve their spot where they're camping out.
Very good point. Very good point. Sir, go ahead.
Hi. My name's Andrew Thornton. As Taylor Boone will attest, I'm a somewhat acknowledged poet and public speaker. I was a participant in Michael Nye's hunger exhibit at the Witte. I read some of my poetry at that exhibit, so I got some bona fides. I want to address the feeding that y'all were talking about. And I welcome anybody to address what I'm about to say. It's a statement and a question at the same time. In the last year, three faith-based places that were feeding sack lunches were closed down for health department violations. Each one of these places existed for roughly 25 years before this happened, with the same violations without being shut down. Since Haven for Hope, all three conveniently have fallen through the cracks. The little church at La Vita, who gave peanut butter sandwiches, the Catholic Worker House, which provided donuts, coffee, and stuff, and a place run by the First Baptist Church we just called Miss Winnie's, all shut down within the last year. Now, because of the sudden lack of sack lunches, I'm also a member and work part-time for Travis Park. We see a large influx of new faces coming to us from Haven for Hope to eat. So how do you justify the closing of the three faith-based institutions, which operated for a period of combined 75 years in violation without being bothered, and all of a sudden those violations were important enough to get them shut down?
Thanks. This comes back again to the issue of having enough locations around the city to feed the homeless. And panelists, let's just open it up. Anybody want to respond to those comments?
Well, I know there are churches all over San Antonio, and certainly Street Under Bridge attempted was doing this, as feeding as many people as we can. And again, it's we can't just say Haven for Hope has to feed everybody. That's not possible. Even here it says each year 25,000 men, women, or children are experiencing homelessness. When we talk about 2,500 people a night spending sleeping in the San Antonio streets, that's baloney. There are many, many more than that. Take that times 10 from the number of people going hungry. And then if you have diabetes, and I'm glad you're having a whole town hall, if you get donuts and coffee, you're going to go into a diabetic coma, you know. And part of it is we're not even providing reasonable food for people. So that's a big issue.
And if I could respond to that as well. In the development of Haven, I was one that was fairly outspoken in some aspects of it. And I think there was a broad-based community understanding that Haven for Hope was going to be the panacea for homelessness. That's absolutely false. Haven for Hope is not to develop to feed the entire city in terms of marginalized people. We're really there specifically to serve homeless people. And yes, there are issues. And Haven is a piece of a continuum. On the front end of that continuum is homeless prevention. We should be preventing people from ever losing their homes, losing their apartments, to have a need for Haven for Hope. The reality is that's happening. So we need a Haven for Hope. We need a place for people to go when they become homeless. On the backside of the campus, there's also a huge need for permanent affordable housing once people leave, as well as the issue that we're talking about of food for marginalized populations, which can lead to homelessness. If forced between choosing food and choosing rent, I'm probably going to go with that primary need first, but then at the end of the month, you can't pay rent.
Melanie, go ahead.
And I would just add also, I'm not with the health department, but as far as the city's role in shutting down feeding organizations, there actually hasn't been a hard enforcement of the health department regulations. There has been an education campaign. There have been some warnings to feeding organizations that are maybe operating outside of health and safety ordinances, but there has not been a strict enforcement. We are aware that there are organizations that have stopped operating, maybe in fear of strict enforcement or those types of activities, but it hasn't been because the city has shut them down. From the very beginning of Haven opening, we've wanted to ensure there was enough food for the homeless. There has been a coordinated effort to engage the feeding organizations at Haven for Hope, and help them transition to providing their meals and providing their services at the campus and in the safe sleeping courtyard. That is a strategy, and the transition team that we've been working with Haven for Hope and the Center for Healthcare Services, mental health workers, and the health department and SAPD has really been focused on the soft enforcement approach until we can be sure that there's enough shelter and food for the homeless.
Great. Sir, thanks for your patience. Go ahead.
My name is Buster, and I am a resident over at Hope for Haven. And when he was talking about them feeding us, if you want to talk about a small little bowl of cereal like this, feeding us for breakfast, that's supposed to be the main meal of the day. How does that one little tiny bowl like that fill a person for the whole day, give them the energy? Plus, when they feed us, when they were talking about hot meals, you get a small little tray like this, maybe a few little pieces of meat in there and this and that. It's not enough to feed a person to fill them for the night when they go to bed. I have to take a sneak snack in just so that I have something to eat during the night because I get hungry because they don't feed us. Church feeds us better than they do. How do you address that? And I am a resident there. So you can't...
On the campus or Prospects Courtyard?
Either one.
Well, on the campus, the
center... campus, I heard, feed a little bit better, but from I heard from some of the residents there, not that much better.
Yeah, the San Antonio Food Bank does the feeding on the campus. On the outside Prospects Courtyard, the feeding is done by St. Vincent de Paul. And that's one of the areas for improvement that we're working on. I mean, this was a two-year project, a lot of planning that went into it. Anyone that's done program development, project development, there's the development phase and implementation, and the two don't always look the same.
Because I'll tell you right now, the name for Hope for Haven, as far as feeding was, they call it the fat camp. You can lose weight. People lost over 20 or 30 pounds in less than a month's time.
Well, there was an original contention in Prospects Courtyard, and some of the early architects of the project, the intent with PCY was to not make homelessness too comfortable, which really is sort of a ridiculous concept. So what we're doing now is we've tried to re-engage churches. We're trying to feed at least one hot meal a day, and St. Vincent de Paul has been working diligently to try to improve the food on Prospects Courtyard. It's still a work in progress.
Like I said, I understand you not wanting to have us get too relaxed, comfortable on that part. But like I said, people that want to go to work and shit, well, excuse my language, I don't mean to say that, sorry. But it makes it harder on them because they don't have the energy because we're not being fed well enough, is my point.
Okay. Buster, thanks. Thanks for your point. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Sir, thanks for your patience. Go ahead.
My name is Jeff Travers. I started out being homeless at First Care of San Antonio, and my question is, if the homeless is such a big part of San Antonio, why aren't the mayor and the congressional people working on that? I went on the internet, I've gone on newspapers, and I've gone on different other places. I haven't seen nothing accomplished by it.
Okay. So your question, again, just...
is why is the mayor and the Congress working on funding and the criteria of the homeless?
Okay. Melody's our representative from the city. I'm going to throw that question to you. And talk a little bit more about the plan, the five-year plan that we've been talking about.
Right. Well, the 10-year plan, which was adopted in 2005, so it, I guess, would go through 2015. But, of course, you know, we know that homelessness probably won't be solved by 2015. It's an ongoing plan, and I would really counter that our mayor and city council are very engaged in, and city manager's office as well, in solving homeless issues and developing strategies and policies to address those issues. We've spent a lot of time on it during the budget process. The city's investment in homeless services has, since 2007, increased tenfold because it is a huge area of interest for our elected officials and our city manager's office.
All right, thank you.
Anybody else on the panel want to comment on this gentleman's question about what the city is doing or how well the city is working on the issue of homelessness. A broad topic, but I just want to throw that out to the rest of the panelists. Okay, let's move forward, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Juliet Pearson Romo, and I live at Haven for Hope currently, and I think I may be the only one here looking around, which is disappointing.
Come a little closer to the microphone. Thank you.
I have a comment and a question. First, I'd like to comment on the food situation. I've been at Haven for almost 6 months now and spent 2.5 months in Prospect Courtyard. And I must say that what the gentleman had to say about the food situation there is absolutely accurate, and probably putting it more mildly than most of the people I hear. We're talking about cereal, instant milk, you know, and a stale donut and two bologna sandwiches. And that's what I ate for 2.5 months. And if you're not there when it's handed out, if you're job hunting or taking care of issues, making appointments, you're not going to eat. Moving over to the other side, it's marginally better, but still it's an issue. The food is inadequate and, not the issue at hand, however. My question is, why is the population at Haven for Hope immediately disqualified for care links because we don't have a valid address? And were you aware of that?
Just to clarify, CareLink is the Bexar County healthcare system, basically for the working poor. Just want to put that out there. Scott, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm a veteran, and this is not a personal issue for me at this point, but it was in the beginning, and I know many, many people who are just like, but it makes no sense.
The question, can you repeat?
When I went to the CareLink office and gave them my ID and address for Haven for Hope, they told me I was not qualified for CareLinks because I was at Haven for Hope and it was not a valid home address.
And the question is, why is that? Scott, go ahead.
I do not work for a university health system, so I can give you the answer only as far as I know and what I've been told. And there has been information and misinformation and confusion around that whole issue. As many of you may know, Central Med is the primary health care provider on the campus, so everybody has access to the primary health care. What CareLink would provide is specialty health care, and some people have been able to enroll and some people have been turned down, and I'm not sure as to the rhyme or reason in either way. It's as the primary and the lead medical organization on the campus, Central Med. I have kicked that up to their CEO. He's in dialogue with University Health System. I wish I had a solid answer for you, but again, it's one of those things that we're working on and trying to figure out.
Great.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Taylor.
Well, this continues to be a problem in San Antonio of access to health care, primary care. I know Central Bar, they're operating the clinic, but it again assumes that people can have the social skills sometimes to or bus passes to be able to get to an appointment to get to the service, and we have people having to wait 3, 4, and 5 weeks just to get in to see a physician. When they're seeing a physician, it's not a physician, it's PA. For that reason, we have every Sunday, we have a cardiologist, we have internists, we have a whole row of physicians and nurses that come and work at Travis Park providing free health care. We also, the University of Texas, runs a dermatology clinic every once a month and on a Wednesday night. So the health care is right there with food. They go together. And, again, the demand is far greater than the services.
We've got a line forming. I just want to remind individuals we only have about 50 minutes left, so let's get to our statement and get to our question as fast as we can. Sir, go ahead. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Raymond Zavala, and I'm a candidate for City Council in District 5. Ironically, I don't see Patty Radel, the Mother Teresa of the West Side, here and for the homeless. Obviously, she probably didn't get the word. However, my question is this. When are we going to hold city government responsible for their spending? They gave up a lot more money to take care of the animals, stray animals, than they do about humans. Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you this. I'm probably the most compassionate person in the world. I have a family living with me because they had nowhere else to go. They applied at the Haven for Hope, and they were turned down. The little girl is 15 years old. She's as bright as a tack. I take her to school every day, and I pick her up after school every day. We feed her. We clothe her. Her mom was in a violent relationship. I don't know about you, but I let them stay in one of my rental homes for 10 months without paying me a cent. If that isn't compassion and loving and caring for the people of the United States of America, then I don't know what is. I've tried to get her help. There's not enough money in housing to get her her own place. I've tried to get her counseling. She doesn't qualify. Why? Because she lives under my roof. She doesn't get food stamps. Why? Because she doesn't pay me rent. And if she were to pay me rent, I wouldn't take it. But at Haven for Hope, there's a lot of major issues. There's assaults. There's assaults by the cadre. By cadre, I mean the people in charge of security, of making sure that people get what they need. I now house a family, a man and two of his children, in one of my rental homes because he was kicked out for eating a bag of potato chips. A lousy bag of potato chips, and they were thrown out.
So I also got a number of examples. Let's just get, yes. Can we go to get to your question?
Okay. My question is this. Why isn't the city government doing more for the humans instead of the pets, the loose animals, the stray animals? Also, I'd like to get a copy of the Haven for Hope financial report. I'd like to see where all that money that they got in this year's budget is going to go and where the money has been going since they've been getting funding. Okay. I want to know the salaries.
Great. Thank you, sir. We've got a multi-issue question there, and I want to get several people involved in this. First, Marta, I want to bring you into the conversation here. This gentleman was talking about family and some individuals that are affected by domestic violence. This is an opportunity for you to tell us about the programs that your organization provides and how domestic violence affects homelessness. Let's start there.
Very simply, let me just say that a study done by UTSA demonstrates that 69% of the homeless in San Antonio have a history of domestic violence. So the relationship between domestic violence and homelessness is a very close one. We have a program that is based right now at Haven for Hope. For the past 15 years, this program has been linking services, substance abuse, mental health, legal services, counseling to all of the homeless shelters in San Antonio. We also were perplexed by the closing of some of those shelters that had been providing services to centralize all services under one roof. The initiative is worthwhile conceptually, and sometimes things that conceptually work not always work at the implementation level. So as Scott said, 2 years in the making is not a valid test yet. So these conversations are very healthy in the sense that gives us all agencies providing services and the people that receive the services an opportunity to explore what is working, what is not working, and how can we all together make it better.
Thank you, Marta. And Scott, the gentleman who previously asked this question was making some claims about maybe some violence on the campus at Haven and a family being turned away. A couple of questions here. What are the qualifications for a family or individuals to get accepted into Haven, and what are the policies and implementations for dealing with violence on campus, I guess?
We've got a group of life safety officers that provide the security on campus, and there is, and I hear it on the streets all the time, a lot of urban legend at best about violence on the campus. Really, since opening, we've had very, very few acts of violence, and generally the acts of violence are people living there against people living there. So we're there to keep a safe environment. The second part, in terms of the financial statement, I'm not the CFO, but as a nonprofit, nonprofit agencies do a 990 each year, which describes their financial state. This is our first year in operation. We've only been open about 5 months, so that would be probably next year in January, I think, is when it's due.
Okay, great. Sir, thanks for your patience. Go ahead.
Yes. My name is Michael Idrogo. I believe the city should get out of the business of charity and allow the charities to conduct the business of charity themselves. I think it was a mistake for the city to be spending so much money on the Haven for Hope. However, now that it's built, you know, they should take hands off. I have lived in Asia and Africa, and let me tell you, and you may well know, half the world sleeps outdoors at night. There's nothing wrong, there's nothing mental, there's nothing criminal of people sleeping outdoors. There's no problem at all. Even the little kids in Africa would wake up happy. They may be hungry there in Africa as they are hungry here, and of course we do need to provide food for them, but there's nothing wrong with persons sleeping outdoors. In the history of mankind, too, cities have always provided public squares. We have public squares here, Travis Square, not Travis Park, Columbus Square, Washington Square, which is covered up as a farmer's market, and a number of other squares here in town. The Supreme Courts have always ruled that those public squares are part of the streets, and thereby persons can be there 24 hours a day. They are not to be chased away by the police, which is done so here in town. There's a policy here of round them up, hide them, and that way they're out of sight and out of mind. That's what's going on here in San Antonio, which is a major mistake.
Michael, what's your question?
What the city should concentrate on is lower rents and employment. My question is, and I wanted to go on, there's other major cities, too, that are having the homeless problems, of course, around the country. Hawaii has got their homeless sleeping on the beach. They are now providing a one-way ticket to the mainland to get rid of their homeless. I wanted to ask that the city encourage the top 100 major cities in the U.S. to send their homeless here to San Antonio so we can use the Homeless Academy as an academy to train them to better themselves and be individualistic and carry out their own lives.
Okay, great. Great statement. So, okay. Unpacking what Michael said a little bit, my understanding is he had some issues with the city being involved in homeless services to begin with at all. Melody, back over to you. Looking at this 10-year plan, can you give us an idea of why the city decided to get involved in the way that they did?
Well, the city has been, like I said earlier, the lead agency for the continuum of care of Bexar County and San Antonio for years. And what that means is that the HUD funding, one of the major HUD funding sources for homelessness, comes through the city. The city is the fiscal agent. With the, you know, actually with the changes in the at the federal government level to the McKinney-Vento Act, what's called the Hearth Act, will probably change the way that's structured. Where we're looking right now at working with the county and the San Antonio Housing Authority, as well as the San Antonio Regional Alliance for the Homeless, on what that should look like, what the city's role should be, what the county's role should be, and what the housing authority's role should be, as well as what the individual providers should be doing and have the capacity to do, and again, how we build the capacity of the community providers to take on more of that work.
Anybody else on the panel have any comments to what Michael's talked about with open squares and more outdoor living arrangements? Anybody at all? Okay. Sir, go ahead.
My name is John Butchkowski. I'm with the San Antonio Alliance for Human Needs. I have a lot of questions, but I'm going to restrict them to three in light of the fact that this is a limited program and time-wise. My first question is this. San Antonio has long been a magnet for undocumented individuals. This is nothing new. You hear a lot about it from time to time when the media needs a story, but the truth of the matter is, for the last 100 years or so, San Antonio has been a magnet. My question in regards to the undocumented is this. What resources exist for a person who is homeless and also undocumented? I raise this question because undocumented people frequently have difficulty providing the form of identification that some homeless service providers would require. I'm not pointing fingers at anyone, but what I'm saying is some people will say, if you don't have an ID, we can't help you. Okay. And the undocumented basically would have a hard time coming up with an ID. The second question I have, and I'll make it fast.
Please do.
Is services for what I would call people who are betwixt and between. They're a little old to be considered children, yet they're a little young to really fit into standard adult services. And I'm referring to people in, let's say, the 16 to 25 age range. And very quickly, you have some very notable programs that exist for children, and you have some programs that exist for adults. But if you're going to get, say, someone who's 17 or 18 or 19, that's a very awkward proposition. And I'm wondering what the panel would have to say about that group.
Okay.
And the third question I have is this, and this third issue has been addressed a little bit in the San Antonio Express News. I suspect it will come up again, and that is the issue of discharge planning, especially for medical facilities. There was a story not too long ago about the Haven for Hope becoming a dumping ground, as the newspaper put it, for people who were being released from hospitals because the hospital was getting nervous about the fact that they might be financial difficulties with them meeting their obligations, so they were stabilized and basically given a one-way ride to the Haven for Hope. In the past, these same people were sending people over to the Salvation Army on Nolan Street, and I suspect they still might be sending people to Nolan Street, but they've added the Haven for Hope on their list of places to discharge these people, and I'm wondering what the panel would have to say about this sort of, what would you call it? I don't like the word dumping, but again, the newspaper used it. The technical word, I believe, is inadequate discharge planning. People get out of a medical facility or some other place. Doesn't have to be a hospital, but they need to have some place to go to that's safe and, you know, where their needs can be met. So those are my three questions.
Great, great. Three very good questions. The first question, what services are provided for undocumented workers? Second question is, what services are provided by agencies for, we'll say, late adolescent, early young adult individuals between the ages of 17 and 25? And then another very important question about individuals who may be discharged from medical facilities who have persistent physical or mental health problems. What services are there for them, and are the homeless services we have in the city ready to accept them and cater to their needs? I'm going to open it up to the panel, whoever would like to address any one of those three questions.
I'm going to offer to address, in reference to the battered women in children's shelter, the undocumented piece of the question. I couldn't agree more with the gentleman in that there are some basic needs, human basic needs, that should not be circumscribed to place of precedence or whether you have the proper documentation or not. You're hungry and everybody in the world, doesn't matter what borders you've crossed or not, we all know what that is. At the Battered Women and Children's Shelter, we take the same attitude towards domestic violence. Immigration status is not an issue. It is not something that we inquire. We require as a requisite for shelter. That's my contribution to the three-part question.
Great. Thank you, Marta. Anybody else want to weigh in on those three questions? Scott?
I can weigh in on the hospital discharge issue as a response to one of the stories in the Express News. Representative Menendez and Senator Vanderpute convened a task force consisting of homeless service providers and the hospitals to come up with solutions for that very issue. So we do have protocols that are now released. The hospitals are making contact with the Haven for Hope and Salvation Army before they discharge there. There is still a gap that this task force is charged to look at, and that gap is somebody might be medically ready to be discharged from the hospital, but still not well enough to make it in a shelter environment. So we're looking at potential solutions for that as well vis-a-vis this task force.
And I just want to address the gentleman's third question about services for young adults, older adolescents and young adults. Very interesting demographic, and I believe that demographic of homelessness is rising. Taylor, maybe you can talk about seeing some of those individuals.
We're seeing more and more young people come out, and a lot of these are kids coming out of foster children. You know, they rotate out, they're 18, they're kicked out because somebody's not getting paid to take care of them. And what I see is they're hooking up with people who lead them down the wrong path. So there needs to be more intervention. And, I mean, they're always welcomed in our church, and we serve them. Just like I could care less if you're an alien. In fact, the scriptures tell us that one of the three things we're supposed to take care of: widows, orphans, and the alien. And I'm not talking about from outer space. We're all aliens somewhere around here. So it's a serious problem for young kids because they become wise in the world, and then after the fact, they've been damaged. So there aren't services. We refer when we can to a battered women's shelter and otherwise, but mental health services very quickly is and the pathway that the city has funded has also helped with mental health services for a lot of the young folks. But again, they're overwhelmed.
Thanks, Taylor. Sir, go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to ask this question. As we all should know by now, I keep up with the news on the internet every day on major news stations. Like, everybody knows what they are, okay? As of right now, the city, in 3 months, the city is going to plan to enforce these ordinances against homeless people because San Antonio's fantasy is to drive homeless people out of San Antonio, so that means they have to go to Haven for Hope or they're going to go to jail, okay? So I was wondering, how is the city going to enforce that?
Sir, and if you wouldn't mind identifying yourself on the microphone.
I'm Herman Johnson.
Okay, thank you. Melody, since you're a representative from the city, I know that you're not in charge of law enforcement and other parts of that equation, but can you address this gentleman's concern or his idea that that there will be only two options, Haven for Hope or jail?
Right. The city doesn't have a timeline for enforcing. There are what's called quality of life ordinances. It includes the no camping in public places, those types of ordinances, but there's not a timeline for enforcing that. Our plan right now is a transition plan, an outreach plan. We work with the Center for Healthcare Services and the Haven for Hope caseworkers, the San Antonio Police Department, to do outreach and education, to talk to people who are either living on the street or in encampments or in doubled-up situations about their options and places they can go. But there's not a enforcement effort out there with the police department. They're not rounding people up and throwing them in jail.
Great. Anybody else want to weigh in on that at all? I think that covered it. Ma'am, go ahead. Thanks for your patience.
I'm Janet Grigsby. I'm the executive director for Stand Up for Kids, and we are a national all-volunteer organization that helps homeless and at-risk youth. We've just expanded our demographic to 25 and younger. Hallmark of what we do is street outreach. We do street outreach 2 to 3 times a week. The first thing I wanted to say is that I believe that Haven for Hope's premise of what they're trying to do with transformational change for homeless people is the way to go. And I support that endeavor entirely. We could not do, Stand Up for Kids could not do what we do without the help and assistance of a myriad of other agencies who provide things we can't provide, we provide things they can't provide. We rely on each other. But I do believe that until Haven for Hope and the city acknowledges that the gap is too big, that the efforts to close everything else down, essentially, and believe that all of that could be served at Haven is completely unrealistic. Sometimes we don't know these things when we set out to do something, but I think that the time has come for a ownership of the fact that that is not working, and that there are people in the community who can and will rise to the need to meet the needs of the people that are homeless in the city. There's too many, and it's a bottleneck at Haven. Since Haven has opened, we have not helped a single youth or young adult family that's been able to get into Haven for a variety of different reasons. So, you know, we can do these town halls, we can talk about these things, but I think until there's a real ownership that it's not working the way that it is. Transformation can take place at Haven, but shelter and feeding cannot be done by this one agency. That's all I want to say.
Scott, Melody, anybody else on the panel address these comments about Haven being one of the central and only ministries in town that can help the homeless? Scott?
I couldn't agree more. The Haven for Hope and any one entity in the city, it cannot address the issues of homelessness. You hear the statistics, 25,000 annually, on any given night, 2,200. Haven for Hope doesn't have the capacity. It's definitely a community effort. And I know of Stand Up for Kids. I used to work with young adults emancipating from foster care. I know the needs of the 18 to 25-year-old beyond marginalized, oftentimes kicked out of the system at 18 without supports. There's been some national changes with that, and I would welcome an opportunity to engage in a conversation with Stand Up for Kids and talk about how we can work together to address that particular population.
We are an off-campus provider.
Well, you and I need to talk.
Melody, I know this topic keeps coming up, but let's just talk about it again in the context of this person's comments about this concern that there's an effort by the city to make Haven the only place where the homeless can be served in this community.
Right, and as Scott said, it is a community-wide effort, and I think the city is very engaged with numerous partners just through our funding process that we go through every 2 years. We're contracting with 90 different agencies in the community to provide a variety of services, not just homeless services, but youth services and early education services, financial self-sufficiency services. So Haven is not the only agency that we work with. And as far as homeless, there's over $11 or $12 million in grant and general fund that goes to probably 20 to 30 different agencies. And so there are shelters all over the community that the city is working with, not just in a funding relationship, but in a partnership relationship. And so absolutely, you know, we acknowledge that there's a community-wide effort. It's not just Haven for Hope.
And before we get to the next question, I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to a town hall forum on homelessness on KSTX San Antonio 89.1 FM. Sir, thanks for your patience. Go ahead.
No problem. This is my first one being at this, so I'm kind of nervous. Justin Holloway, Prospects Courts. The thing about Prospects Court, and I don't think anybody gets it, is you're outside in the cold, in the rain. It takes staff I don't know how long to figure out when it's going to rain when everybody else knows outside. It's going to rain. It has to actually be raining before you go inside. And even then, when you get inside, there is no room. When it got 27 degrees, they moved the women to another cafeteria and moved what men they could get inside. There was not enough room. A majority of us had to sleep outside. Now, I don't understand how you can say it's helping, it's trying to get the homeless to better themselves when you have us sleeping outside on mats. You know, get us out of the cold. And instead of it being an option where you can sleep inside or sleep outside, it shouldn't be an option. You know, I have seen fights there. I've seen LSOs get a little hacked off. I've seen staff, you know, get agitated because somebody asked a question, they got kicked out for 24 hours. Now, is that really helping the homeless by kicking them out for 24, 48, however many hours, thinking that's going to solve the problem? It's not. I'm sorry. My question is, another question is, like Buster was saying, little bowl of cereal and coffee is not going to get us fed. But two bologna sandwiches and all this other stuff at lunch is not going to get us fed. A little thing at lunch or dinner is not going to get us fed. The only time I've seen any of us eat really good is when you have the camera crews there or the news crews there or when you have the news or when you have news people there, when you have newspaper people there, and they don't ask any of us how it's actually like out here. And I wish they would, because then the public would know what it's like.
Thank you, sir. Scott, responding to that, some of the issues that are going on in Prospects Court with food and shelter?
Well, in terms of the shelter, we do have in place an inclement weather plan. When temperatures get low or it starts to rain, we do open up inside. Is it crowded? Probably yes. Do people have the option to sleep inside? Absolutely. The other thing with Prospects Courtyard, the difference out there, it's very low demand. It was meant to be low demand. It's a safe sleeping zone. There's not an expectation that people need to be sober when they come there. You don't have to have ID, so it's very low demand versus the campus, which really the campus is about people that want to change their condition and are making a conscious choice to engage in that process. So we do provide the inclement weather as much as possible, and I appreciate this feedback. I mean, we're a new program. We do have a lot of areas for improvement, and this is the way that we can get feedback to improve.
Sir, thanks for your patience. Go ahead.
Hello. My name is Drew Schaefer. I'm a student at Keystone School. As many of you may have heard, one of our councilmen, John Clamp, tried to ban begging about a year ago. What do you think would be the effects of this, and what do you think a better option would be?
Melody, I'll defer to you because it's a city ordinance issue about begging or panhandling What is sort of the city's policy on that? And can you give us a little more? Background on how that if there's anything in our 10-year homelessness plan that addresses that?
The 10-year plan really doesn't address panhandling. There is a quality of life ordinance that bans aggressive panhandling, and that's panhandling where they're interfering with traffic in the public right of way. But there's not anything in place right now that bans panhandling altogether.
Okay. Great.
I'd like to comment on
sure,
that.
Go ahead, Taylor.
That's not how I'm seeing it enforced. I'm having people being arrested or ticketed for, they call it flying a sign, and it's no different than some of the guys that are selling papers. And so it seems to me like we've got a double standard. If you're out there and being supported by somebody that pays you to do something, you can stand in the middle and pass out something, but if you're standing there asking for food or something, you're going to get arrested. And I think we've got some failure to enforce the ordinances, and those that are enforced, it's pitiful that money is driving how we're taking care of people out there, and it's not about treating people equally.
Thanks, Taylor. Sir, go ahead. Thanks for your patience.
Hi, my name is Jose Medina, and I had the opportunity for at least 3 years to serve the homeless under the bridge on Commerce and Frio, which is relatively close to Haven for Hope. And I just want to express that there's some always negative and bad things about anything. And for all the negative that's been said about Haven for Hope, I'm sure there's a lot more positive as well that hasn't been said. However, with that being said, I just want to ask, why is there such a disconnect with the local churches who have fed and the local organizations who have fed with Haven for Hope? Why is there a disconnect? Because ultimately it's about helping homeless people. I guess my second part of that question is, there's a lot of willing people to help. And the arena of food, clothing, you know, things of this nature. And why hasn't Haven for Hope, if any, has not taken advantage of these people willing to help at the expense of their dime and their time in such a huge need? And then my third point was, I know there's a lot of willing people. Could you also talk about the volunteering services for people so people can get involved in helping with homeless people or people who are in domestic violence situations, just to allow people to, you know, if they feel empowered to do so, that they can help?
Great. It's okay. Scott, we'll start with you on that question because I think it was directed at you, but I think other people on the panel might want to talk about, too, how volunteers are networked in the organization, or maybe even take this as an opportunity to talk about some volunteer opportunities with their organizations. But, Scott, go ahead.
Well, and the first part regarding the churches and feeding under the bridge is amen. We, as a community, there was a perception, be it real or not real, that churches were no longer welcome in terms of feeding the homeless. That's absolutely errant. In fact, in my relatively short tenure at Haven, we have been assertively going back to churches that used to do a lot of the street feeding and trying to re-engage them in that ministry. It's an important opportunity for churches to minister to people as well as bring invaluable resources to the campus. So we absolutely welcome that resource and are really trying to re-engage and encourage a faith organization and churches to engage with us in that. That's
okay, sir, if we're going to ask questions, get in line. But Scott, go ahead.
And then the second part, we absolutely welcome and need volunteers in all aspects of Haven for Hope. And the best recommendation I can give for volunteering is go to our website, and on the website you'll see a listing of the partners. So if you're interested in serving food, you can volunteer with the San Antonio Food Bank or St. Vincent de Paul. SAM Ministries operates the dormitory. They look for all kinds of assistance with special events. We've got teen rooms that need to be staffed, children's room that need to be staffed. So volunteer experiences and opportunities abound on the campus, and we welcome.
Would anybody else on the panel like to take an opportunity here to talk about networking with volunteers or volunteer opportunities?
I would second everything that Scott has said. Volunteering is a large part of our organizations. I have a staff of 84 people and 63 volunteers. So volunteering is a backbone of our operation, opportunities, direct services, clerical tasks, helping with the children, residential, non-residential, a lot of wonderful opportunities. But the most wonderful thing about volunteering is that it connects the community directly with the services that our agencies provide.
Jerry, I've got one. I have a challenge to all the churches out there. We made a commitment not to move people away from the church, but instead invite them to become members of our church, and we establish relationships. So there's a difference between we need volunteers over at Haven for Hope, but I think all the churches, if they looked three blocks around their church, they'll find people that are homeless, they'll find children in crisis, they'll find abuse going on. In fact, the statistics say that there's probably significant abuse going on in their congregation. They just want to put their head in the sand. There's enough for the churches to do and welcome people. It's all about relationships. When you stick folks all away from the churches, how you expect them to get in relationship with the rest of community? They can't.
Sir, go ahead. If you could identify yourself again, I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
My name is still Andrew Thornton. I'm still homeless. I just want to make a short statement from the Theater of the Absurd. Now, there's a lot of people, bureaucrats, all kinds of people, who depend on the fact of homelessness for their paychecks. And so, in essence, they're riding on our backs. If anybody here could snap their fingers and end homelessness right now, many of those people would become the new homeless.
Sir, go ahead.
Oops. Hello, my name is Eugenio Rodriguez, and I appreciate what you said, Pastor. When you're going to help the homeless, those are the ones you ask. But something came up regarding affordable housing. When this project came to light, the location really bugged me. I looked into it. It really bugged me that it's between two railroad tracks, two active railroad tracks. Most recently, there was an emergency response that was required to either side. It turns out none of the vehicles could get to the emergency itself. Why? Because the train was blocking the tracks. For those that remember, there was a bridge fire. The train bridge burned. Well, both sides of the track were blocked. Thank goodness the campus wasn't there yet. But most recently, I came across a sign that said public notice, affordable housing, 141 units. And it's inside the tracks. And I'm wondering, when are we going to wake up and really defend them as our fellow human beings, equal to us? The things that you talk about, putting everything in one place, it doesn't happen outside of that bucket that we created through ordinances. You would never put a daycare next to services that provide for rehab and things of that nature, of serious things. You talk about domestic violence, you would not have them all put together in one bucket. Out here, it would all be separated to protect the communities. They are a community. They are our fellow citizens. Yeah, they might be homeless, so be it. But we must protect them as equally as we protect ourselves. Now, again, I reiterate, first of all, that location, for those of you that are not aware, there was a $50,000 environmental study. Well, if they had adhered to what the environmental study said, the city would have saved $10 million right off the bat. Was it all cleaned up? I don't know. Because a lot of the things, as long as you don't disturb them, and as long as you put asphalt or you put cement, it's okay. But that's okay, I guess, because they're homeless. I guess they're like Superman. They don't get hurt by contaminants. That concerns me. So please, whoever's giving money to these projects, I sincerely wish they would reconsider the location. One, the contaminants, okay, those can be taken care of, supposedly. Two, the two railroad tracks that are there. Now, I was told, don't worry, Mr. Rodriguez. We have gone ahead and talked to the train companies, and hopefully in the future, we will not have hazardous materials going through. A train wreck doesn't happen like an intersection wreck. A train wreck takes up whole blocks. People aren't aware of that. Any wreck with a train makes the train stop. Now, I'm not just talking about the homeless safety,
sir,
but I'm talking about the employees, volunteers, and others that go into this vicinity, that they be made aware of the situation they're being put in.
Great. I appreciate your comments. I'm going to have Scott comment on them in just a second, but I just want to remind everybody we have about 12 minutes of the broadcast left. I know a lot of you have been waiting in line for a very long time, so if you can come up here and get to your question as soon as we can, I can guarantee almost that we can probably get to everybody if we can get right to their question. Scott, any comments about the physical location of Haven and those railroad tracks? Have they been a hazard?
Well, one, I didn't choose the site, and two, it's not ideal. It's a nuisance, and it's a nuisance to get on the campus for the staff and as well as the residents on the campus. We are trying to work with the railroads to make it a quiet zone and to ensure the safety, and those are discussions in process.
Regarding quiet zones, sir, what that does, which people are not aware of, railroad companies love those. Why? Because they pass the liability to municipalities. Now, municipalities are immune. But what do quiet zones do? They close off more crossovers. When you close off a crossover, now emergency vehicles need to seek another venue. So I am not at all in favor of quiet zones. Why? Because a lot of the folks there are not in cars. They're usually walking around. And it's good to have that horn blare to wake them up and hopefully keep them off the tracks. So, yeah, it's a convenience for us. Oh, we hate the noise. Oh, it bothers me. Oh, it woke me up at night. Oh, this. But then when you see a body that's there and you can't identify, that's a different story. So please be very careful with quiet zones, not only in this case, but throughout the city.
Great. Thank you, sir. Ma'am, thanks for your patience. Go ahead.
Hello. My name is Bonnie Carl. I've heard a lot from the city and from Haven for Hope about wanting to partner with other ministries to feed and clothe and care for the homeless, but it all seems to come back to being inside the wire. There are organizations that have been feeding the homeless out on these streets long before either of you knew we had a problem. Okay? Why can we not feed and serve our fellow man, our homeless brethren, where they are, not where you would have them be. We're not asking for your funding. We're not asking to partner. We're asking to be able to serve the least of these, as our Lord has commanded us to do, where they are. We don't always need y'all. We've been doing it. We can continue doing it. There is enough of them to go around. Is there any consideration given to the fact that you all are not able to meet the entire need? Why are we forbidden, even legislated against, zoned out of being able to serve the homeless on the street where they are right now with the food we have to give them?
Thank you, Bonnie. Reverend Boone, do you want to start off with this one? Once again, we're talking about...
I hereby declare feeding everywhere.
I motioned to Taylor because he was having some strong emotional responses when this woman was talking, so I thought we'd start off with him. But once again, we're coming back to the issue of street feeding and the city allowing ministries to get out there and feed the homeless where they are, not necessarily steering them toward one geographical site. Taylor, if you have some comments on that. Melody, I know we've talked about it before. Maybe we can talk about it one last time. Anybody?
Well, I defer to Melody. I'd be out there feeding everybody I could.
Okay.
Well, I think, again, the concern is for the health and safety of the food that's being served, but also that people are eating in places that are sanitary, that there's facilities there for hand washing and bathrooms. That's the goal, is that people are sleeping and eating in a humane environment and receiving the services that they need.
Let's let Melody respond, please. Thank you.
I'm finished.
Okay, great. Sir, let's move on. We've only got about 4 minutes, 5 minutes left before I have to do closing remarks. So, sir, please, your name and write to your question.
All right. My name is Chris Sherlock, and my question is there any way to tighten up on the possible sex offenders going into Haven for Hope because of the fact that at this point in time, I used to stay there. I got thrown off campus just because someone made the allegations that they thought I was a convicted child molester. And the only thing I had on my record at that time was an ACD from when I was 17 for assault in the third up in New York. And now, currently, I have a criminal trespass that, thank God, was time served back in October. The only thing I want to know, is there any way that security protocols can, or the intake protocols can be tightened up. That way, you can get everyone's criminal background nationwide, whether it's sealed or not, because of the fact that that right there is going to end up becoming a bone of contention in the future.
Okay, great. Scott, can you respond to that and maybe some of the guidelines or qualifications about criminals or potential criminals on campus?
Yeah, and we won't talk, Chris, about the particular situation, but generally that's exactly what we're doing. We are going to start to conduct a nationwide criminal background check on people coming into the campus for a couple of reasons. One, so we can ensure the safety. We do not allow anybody that's a convicted sex offender on the campus because we have children on the campus. The second piece of that, it's really helpful for us in working with people to upfront know if there is a criminal history, because as you may know, it's often more difficult to get jobs and access to entitlements and supportive housing and those types of things if you have some criminal record or particularly felony in your background. So it's helpful for us to know that to be able to effectively serve people. So that is the direction we're going, Chris.
Okay, great. Sir, identify yourself again, please, who wouldn't mind.
I'm Herman Johnson. I'm going to make this quick. I got one question. Like you mentioned before, you don't know people getting arrested for hope and signing stuff. And I just asked you one question. You mentioned there's no timeline, and people are getting arrested every day. So how do you come up with that conclusion, I wonder?
Well, I'm not sure what the arrests were for, so I'm not familiar with what you're referring to.
Oh, but since you work for the city, I mean, you have to know
right,
something.
I don't work for the police department.
San Antonio, so, I mean.
Okay.
That's my question. She said there's no timeline, but people getting arrested every day.
Question was addressed, and I think Melody answered it as best she could, so we'll move on. But thank you, sir, for your question. Okay? Ma'am, go ahead. Thank you.
My name is Joan Cheever. I'm a culinary student at St. Philip's, a journalist, a street feeder with Under the Bridge and Resurrection Ministries. I am a bit concerned about how in this country we have Good Samaritan laws, federal and state, and in this city we have an anti-Good Samaritan law, one of the few in the nation. What concerns me is, you know, the Bible says, when I was hungry, you fed me. Did not say, when I was hungry, you checked the city street code to find out if I was hungry inside the central business district or outside. The Bible does also says, when I was hungry, you fed me. You didn't starve me into submission. You didn't give me cold bologna sandwiches. In fact, I think a health code violation would be giving someone cold sandwiches and meals and not, and withholding a hot meal. And with all due respect, Scott, I do not think that a hot dog with chili, chips, and cookies is a balanced meal. On my route, when I cook, they start with the vegetable soup, and if you don't drink the soup, the fresh produce, you don't get the main course. And so I am concerned about how the city can try to enforce this anti-Good Samaritan statute. I know, Melody, you said there aren't any tickets yet, but you know what? The threat is enough. And the threat has stopped volunteers who want, there are a lot of people in this city that want to help, and they are being threatened by the city. And this has got to stop, because we have a duty, all of us, to help our neighbor and to feed people who are hungry. And the people that I feed are not just people that are homeless. They are people that have a roof over their head. They are just hungry. And if you're going to tell me that I have to drive by them because there is a, I believe, an unconstitutional city ordinance, I just don't know how you can reconcile that. Thank you.
Joan, thanks. I feel like we've addressed the street feeding topic a lot, and I think Joan had a lot of great things to bring up there. Joan, if you don't mind, I'm just going to move on to the next question because we're running out of time, but I appreciate your comment. Sir, go ahead.
Senator Rodriguez, I'm going to move very, very quickly. Just a quick question about how do you make a comparison between city-sponsored venues like Fiesta and other type of events, and the church's feeding? I mean, how can you make a comparison as far as sanitation goes, particularly Fiesta? And I'll just leave that. That's a rhetorical question. Let me move on very quickly. What is Haven for Hope doing to help reinstate alienated homeless individuals who've gone to PCY, gone to Haven, and feel that their cause or their rationalization for trying to stay there has been rejected? Now they've completely abandoned the idea, the concept that they can either return to PCY or even Haven. Now they're out there in the streets. I meet with them, I speak with them, I talk to them daily. They're very, very alienated. What is Haven doing to have these people reinstated?
Scott?
Well, what we're doing to have them reinstated basically comes down to the intake criteria. If you are at a point where you're ready to adhere to the rules of the campus and to take part in a plan to end homelessness, you can get back on the campus.
Well, many individuals have already been complaining that they have actually been criminalized unfairly, unjustly, without justification, and without evidence. And I'm hearing this repeatedly, myself included.
Well, and okay. So
let me know what is the current appeal process that's open to these individuals so that they can re-enter Haven or PCY and begin that initial transition in their lives.
Well, you know the appeal process, Edward. We've talked about it, and it's go through case management. Director of case management, and the next level of appeal is me, and then the CEO thereafter.
Okay, and then lastly, what many of these individuals are saying is that we are hearing over and over and over about engage and re-engage the churches. The churches were doing a fine job. I myself ate out in the streets for over a year, never once became ill eating church food. Why are these churches being denied the opportunity to once again re-engage feeding homeless people where they were? And not only that, also providing not only social service, but also providing evangelical service, food, shelter, clothing, assistance in many other ways. And why must it be channeled through the Haven? Why can't it be done externally?
Once again, I think we've addressed that on a number of different levels. So in the interest of time, we're just going to move on. But I appreciate your statements, okay?
I stepped in late, so I missed
it. It's okay. I want to get these last two individuals, their questions heard. So, ma'am, your name and your question, please.
Yes, my name is Mary Cook, and I'm a current resident at Haven for Hope. I moved there from Sam Ministries when they opened for the women in last June. I think Haven for Hope has been a blessing for a lot of people. If you had ever been or stayed at the old building where Sam's Ministries occupied, everyone here would just say, thank God they built us a new place to live. Even if it is a temporary home, and we need to realize that it is only a temporary home and that things are not always going to be perfect. But saying that, I do believe that when we do have concerns, that we should feel like there's someone that we can go to and talk, and that they're going to listen to us and believe us and not take us for being some kind of crazy, idiotic, homeless person with no education, and that we tend to be categorized in, how can I want to say that I have tried. And the community circle that we have is a good medium, but I haven't really seen any results from that. Are we voicing concerns?
What's your question? Let's...
Well, my question is, what can we do to increase and encourage better communication between the staff members of the partners, including Sam Ministries, and the members to improve the communication when it issues concerning living conditions and how we are treated and complaints about the food bank and their lack of nutritious meals.
Okay. Scott, can you address that?
You're right on track. That we do a monthly meeting, a town hall meeting of our own to get feedback from the people that live there about what we're doing well, what's working, and areas for improvement. And that's been a fairly consistent message at those meetings. And I think we're talking about staff working in the dorms and that communication, and it's multi-level and complex, but what I encourage you is to continue to have these conversations, not only in the town hall meetings, but with your caseworker, with me as well. As you probably know, I'm out on the campus to get feedback, because we are definitely in an improvement zone right now.
Okay, thank you very much.
And, sir, the final question of the evening.
Hi, my name is Paul Boyd, and I'm a chef. I'm from New York, and I've been working with the homeless here in San Antonio for the past 6 months. And I just noticed something, that during Fiesta, the city issued temporary food permits to people serving food off the back of anything. It could have been a wheelbarrow. It could have been anything. And yet, the people that are working in the city preparing food, I mean, from churches, Bread and Fishes is one of them. They were preparing food in a school cafeteria with somebody who was certified as a food handler, and they were denied a food permit. Why? And you have people that are getting food permits and whatnot, preachers and whatnot, who are doing things correctly. They're bringing stuff to the street, safe and whatnot. I'm certified by ServSafe as a manager and to teach that class, and I don't understand why they're doing things correctly. They apply for the permits and are denied because those permits are limited. And yet during Fiesta, when it's about making money, you give out hundreds of them. There's something wrong with that.
Okay.
And they can be coming off the ranch with manure on the tires, and they're serving food on the street.
Okay.
And thousands and thousands of people in San Antonio is making money. That's what it's all about. And the people that are feeding people for free, they get persecuted. I don't get it.
Okay.
I don't get it.
No, sorry, we're out of time, sir. We're out of time. We're out of time. I want Melody to answer this question. We're out of time. Yeah. Okay. Melody, could you address maybe some of the concerns about food permitting? I know it might not be your particular department of the city, but is there any way you could address some of those concerns?
Yeah, you know, I actually really don't have additional comment on that. I think we've covered most of the issues.
Okay.
I wish my health department colleague was sitting next to me.
Okay.
I'm not with the health department. Yeah. I think we've addressed it.
Great. We're going to have to wrap up. You've been listening to a town hall on homelessness on KSTX 89.1 FM. I'd like to thank our panel members, Scott Ackerson, Reverend Taylor Boone, Marta Pelais, and Melody Usley. Also, thanks to the San Antonio Central Library and the folks who maintain this beautiful auditorium here. Thanks to Elisa Gonzalez, our volunteer coordinator at KSTX, and all of our volunteers who helped out this evening. Thanks also to Albert Salazar, who manages our station website and printed the programs for this, for tonight's event. Tonight's event was also made possible by Window World and Brickstone Siding. And tonight's panel discussion will be broadcast on KSTX's Newsmaker Hour on Sunday, January 9th. The program will also be available for download on our website. Engineering tonight's program was Fabian Gonzalez. The producer of the KSTX Town Hall series is Ernie Villarreal. I'm your host, Terry Gilday. Thank you for listening and have a good evening. This is KSTX San Antonio 89.1 FM, Texas Public Radio.